Already our worship this morning has concentrated very much on the study passage that we're going to be looking at. It's a long passage from Hebrews 7 through to the middle of chapter 10. And I'm going to read a little more of it now from Hebrews 8. The point of what we're saying is this. We do have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, and who serves in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle set up by the Lord, not by man. Every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. And so it was necessary for this one also to have something to offer. If he were on earth, he would not be a priest, for there are already men who offer the gifts prescribed by the law. They serve at a sanctuary that is a copy and a shadow of what is in heaven. This is why Moses was warned when he was about to build the tabernacle. See to it that you make everything according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. But the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs as the covenant of which he is the mediator is superior to the old one, and it is founded on better promises. For if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. But God found fault with the people and said, "The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, and I turned away from them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more." By calling this covenant new, he has made the first one obsolete. And what is obsolete and aging will soon disappear. What's in a name? That which we call a rose, by any other name, would smell as sweet. Shakespeare's logic, of course, is irrefutable. Words are just vibrations in the air, or marks on a piece of paper. It's what we mean by the word that really counts, isn't it? Would it have made any difference to Juliet's passion for Romeo had he been christened Archibald, I wonder? Clearly she didn't think so. A name, she reasons, is just an arbitrary label. If you don't like the one you've got, you can always change it by deed poll. Who can deny, then? A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. It's obvious. But of course, though that's true, it doesn't mean, does it, that we can afford to be careless with words. I mean, given that it is pure social convention that we designate that particular flower in the garden a rose, it would nevertheless cause considerable misunderstanding if I decided unilaterally to flout social convention in this matter and call it a tulip, wouldn't it? That is Alice's point in her famous debate with Humpty Dumpty in Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. "When I use a word," said Humpty Dumpty in scornful tone, "it means just what I choose it to mean." "The question is," replied Alice, "can you make words mean different things?" Well, the answer is, of course, not without the risk of a great deal of what philosophers call semantic confusion. Now, take the word Christian, just for an example. What does it mean? I find many of the debates I have with people about religion are complicated by the fact that we don't really see eye to eye on that issue. We are working with different definitions of what a Christian really is, and consequently, we are all often found talking across purposes to one another. Some people, for instance, say they are Christians and signify by that simply that they believe in God. Christianity is for them just a rather loose description of their worldview. They are not atheists, therefore they must be Christians. Again, I find there are other people who say they are Christians and mean by that simply that they try to live a good life. Christianity denotes for them a framework of ethical values, doing to others as you would have them do to you, perhaps. They are convinced that they're not morally irresponsible, therefore they are Christians. Or perhaps the most common connotation, which this word Christian embraces in its semantic range, is represented by those who say they are Christians, and mean by that simply that they go to church. Christian for them signifies their participation in certain kinds of devotional practice and ecclesiastical ceremony. They attend confession, they take Holy Communion, they say their prayers. They are religious people, therefore they are Christians. Now I say my problem is that I'm not at all convinced any of these three understandings of the word Christian is really adequate. Of course, I can't stop people using the word in those ways, like Humpty Dumpty. If they want to make words mean what they want to mean, then who can stop them? But in my view, to use the title Christianity as a synonym merely for theism, believing in God, or moralism, trying to be good, or pietism, going to church, that is to fundamentally misunderstand the nature of biblical religion. It's to invite at best confusion, at worst, false assurance. Because, of course, if the Bible is right, at the end of the day, what matters is not what you or I mean by the word Christian, but what God means by it. His interpretation may not determine its entry into the Oxford English Dictionary, but his definition will determine our entry into the world to come. So this morning, what I want to do is to try to clarify this point, this vital issue of definition. What is a Christian? Under this title, a better kind of religion. Tell you the truth, when I woke up this morning and heard the news on the radio, I was sorely tempted to abandon this particular set passage and subject and pull something out of the file that was more immediately appropriate to a Gulf War. And I spent a little while reflecting on that. And then it came home to me, there is, in fact, nothing more relevant that we can talk about this morning, where many thousands of young men and women too, let us not forget, are hovering on the brink of violent death. There is nothing more relevant that we can talk about than what it really means to be a Christian. I assure you there'll be many in the Gulf right now who wish they had clearer notions on that score. And it's the purpose of the author of this letter to the Hebrews to inform us on this very point. As I say, we have chosen a very large, a formidably large passage to survey this morning. But necessarily so, because the author's arguments in these central chapters of the book of Hebrews are very convoluted and overlapping. And it's very easy, I find, to fail to see the wood for the trees. Those of you who have been following this series of studies will know this letter was originally addressed to a group of Jews who had been converted to Christianity, but who under pressure of Roman persecution were being tempted to slide back into their parent Judaism once again. And our writer fears it will be all too easy for them to do that, precisely because they haven't properly grasped the essential meaning of what a Christian is. They're inclined to think of Christianity as little more than a kind of modified Judaism. After all, Christians believe in one God, but then so do Jews. Christians try to obey the Ten Commandments, but then so do Jews. Christians engage in public worship each week, but then so do Jews. In fact, in lots of ways, Judaism had things going for it which Christianity couldn't offer, as far as his readers were concerned. Take, for instance, the spectacle and the drama of the temple ritual in Jerusalem. Now, Christianity had none of that. All you got when you went to church was some boring sermon. Well, Old Testament religion was pretty impressive. Built on that great covenant with the patriarch Abraham and the law which God had given on a mountaintop amid flame and fire and cloud and storm to that great prophet Moses. Well, it had both antiquity and pageantry on its side, did Judaism. And it wasn't hard to see, therefore, how some of these Jewish converts found themselves wondering whether the title Christian really signified anything so vitally important that it was worth suffering for it. After all, they might have said, what's in a name? Christian or Jew. A rose by any other name will smell as sweet. And of course, many are disposed in our day to take precisely the same line, aren't they? Only in the 1990s, the spectrum of world religions which people want to embrace is not just Jew and Christian, but Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist. What's in a name? They say. Well, our author cannot see it that way. His primary purpose in these central chapters is to explain to his Jewish congregation and to us that Christianity is quite different from Judaism. Indeed, it's quite different from every other religion in the world. A Christian is not just a person who is a theist who believes in God. He's not just a moralist who tries to live a good life. He's not just a person who goes to church every week. Now, says our author, a Christian is a person who has embraced a different kind of religion altogether. A better kind of religion, indeed. And he wants to say, as Jews, his original readers should of all people been able to recognize the superiority of Christianity. For their Old Testament, in spite of all the nobility of its laws and the splendor of its ritual, their Old Testament had conspicuously failed to meet the deepest spiritual needs of human beings. Their Old Testament actually looked forward to something better in the future. And in these central chapters, 7 to 10, our author is citing various pieces of evidence to support that claim. Three pieces of evidence in particular, which we're going to look at, and which form the skeletal framework of this long passage. Now, if we can have the overhead on, because it is a long passage, I put them out to minimize your confusion. Here are the three pieces of evidence from the Old Testament itself, which our author wants to cite to prove to his readers that Christianity is a better kind of religion, and they should know, because the Old Testament itself is self-confessedly inadequate and deficient. The first argument forms the basis of chapter 7. It surrounds a quote from Psalm 110 in the Old Testament, and our writer argues that the Bible itself predicts that the Messiah is going to belong to a new order of priesthood. The second claim occupies chapter 8 principally, and is built upon a quotation from Jeremiah chapter 31, the passage we just read a moment ago. And here our author is arguing that the Bible itself states that the old covenant was fatally flawed and anticipates something much better. And then in chapters 9 and 10, in which the writer doesn't so much quote as refer very extensively to the ceremonial provisions of the book of Leviticus, the sacrificial ritual of the Old Testament, he argues the Bible itself indicates that the ritual of the Jerusalem temple was a provisional and ineffective measure. So our task this morning is to get our minds around these three pieces of evidence that form the backbone of our author's thesis here, and then to see how it is that in each case, Jesus provides precisely that kind of better religion to which these deficiencies and anticipations in the Old Testament point. Now, you're going to have patience with me as we do this. Some of our author's arguments this week are a bit esoteric, of great interest, no doubt, to his original Jewish hearers, but a bit remote from us. I don't want you to be discouraged by that. Because I promise you, it is worth sticking with it, because at the end of the study, if nothing else, we shall have understood more clearly what the word Christian really means in God's dictionary, which at the end of the day is the only definition that really counts. All right then, let's start with number one. Chapter 7, the Bible itself predicts that the Messiah will belong to a new order of priesthood, he says. An order of priesthood that has nothing to do with the Jewish law or the temple or Judaism as such. See how he gets to this in verse 11 and verse 17 of chapter 7. If perfection, he says in verse 11, could have been attained through the Levitical priesthood, that was the official priesthood of the religion of Moses, for on the basis of the Levitical priesthood, the law was given to the people, why was there still need for another priest to come, one in the order of Melchizedek, not in the order of Aaron? For, verse 17, it is declared in Psalm 110 in the Old Testament, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Now, there is no figure, perhaps, in the whole of the Bible who is more tantalizing than this extraordinary man whom the author is discussing here in chapter 7, Melchizedek. Maybe you've never heard of him. We meet him first in the Old Testament, way back in the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 14. After Abraham has won a notable battle against a confederation of Middle Eastern kings. Melchizedek is introduced to us as king of Jerusalem, a city, of course, which at that time was not a Jewish city, but a pagan one. He's introduced to us as king of Jerusalem and priest of the Most High God. He shares a covenant meal of bread and wine with the victorious Abraham, and Abraham gives him a tenth of all the booty he has captured in the battle. Now, after that passing reference in Genesis 14, absolutely nothing more is heard of this mysterious person until 1,000 years later, when the psalmist, writing the song we know as Psalm 110, suddenly brings him in again. It's a psalm about the special privileges which God bestows on his chosen king. And the psalmist is inspired to add this line, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek." Now, we can only speculate about the background to this strange allusion to the distant past which the sacred poet suddenly interjects into the psalm so unexpectedly. I have a theory about it, which I'll share with you if you're interested, but it is only a theory. I suspect that Melchizedek is not so much a name as a title. It actually means King of Righteousness in Hebrew. And there is some, albeit slight, evidence that the ancient Canaanite monarchs of Jerusalem may have borne this title as a royal honorific, rather as our queen bears the title Defender of the Faith. Now, if that's so, it's far from impossible that when David eventually captured the city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites, long after Abraham, and made it his capital, that this ancient title for the king of Jerusalem was still being used. And he may have claimed this title for himself and for his dynasty. So Psalm 110 may even be a quote from the coronation liturgy, affirming David's assumption of this ancient throne name of the kings of Salem. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. That, I suspect, is what is going on. But whether I'm right about that historical reconstruction or not, the important thing as far as our author is concerned is that in all kinds of ways, Melchizedek represents a superior order of priesthood to that which Moses appointed in the tribe of Levi. For a start, he says, in the beginning of chapter 7, Melchizedek is not only a priest, he's also a king. King of Salem and priest of God Most High, he says in 7 verse 1. In fact, you could argue he's a king twice over, because his name means King of Righteousness. And then there's the mysterious pedigree of this strange fellow Melchizedek, or rather his lack of pedigree. For he says in verse 3, "Without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life, like the Son of God, he remains a priest forever." See, it's most unusual in tribal societies of the Old Testament time for a person to be mentioned without any attempt to define their ancestral heritage. But Melchizedek enters the story of Abraham like a bolt from the blue. His parents aren't mentioned, neither is there any record of his death. In this respect, says our author, he seems an uncanny anachronism, outside the sweep of the rest of Bible history. Without beginning of days or end of life, like the Son of God, you could say, he remains a priest forever. Now, of course, he's not claiming by that Melchizedek was a supernatural or divine figure, still less that he was a pre-incarnation appearance of Christ, as some older commentators have speculated. Now, that goes far beyond what the text warrants. But Melchizedek's sudden appearance and disappearance in Genesis is significant, he says. It points to the uniquely underived and timeless quality of his priestly authority. He remains a priest forever. And it's on authority, he says, which Abraham himself acknowledged when he surrendered tithes to him, verse 4. "Just think how great this fellow Melchizedek must have been," he says. "Even the patriarch Abraham gave him a tenth of the plunder." Why, he continues in verse 9, you could even argue that Levi, who collects the tithe from Israel under Judaism, himself paid the tithe through Abraham to Melchizedek. Because when Melchizedek met Abraham, Levi was, as it were, still in the body of his ancestor. Clearly then, he says, the priesthood of Melchizedek is superior to that of Levi. It's a royal priesthood. It's an eternal priesthood. It's a majestic priesthood, which even Abraham had to acknowledge. And, he says, it's a priesthood which is still relevant. It has to be relevant, he says, because 1,000 years later, the Davidic king, by God's own oath, is designated in Psalm 110 as a permanent member of this priestly order. It is declared, you are a priest forever, in the order of Melchizedek. So what is the psalmist implying, he says, by such an affirmation? Why, says our author, he's clearly saying that there is something fundamentally unsatisfactory about the hereditary priesthood of Old Testament religion. If perfection, verse 11, could have been attained through the Levitical priesthood, why is there still need for another priest to come, one in the order of Melchizedek, and not in the order of Aaron? No, he says, Psalm 110 is in fact a messianic prophecy. It's pointing forward to the arrival of one whose coming would bring the abrogation of the Old Testament priesthood, and indeed of the whole Old Testament system. For as he says in verse 18, the former regulation is set aside because it was weak and useless. The law made nothing perfect. And a better hope is introduced by which we may draw near to God. Here's his first point then. The Bible itself predicts that the Messiah will belong to a new and superior order of priesthood than anything that Judaism had to offer. And he says, if you have any doubt on that score, I have another text for you to conjure with along the same lines. Turn to chapter 8. And here's the second point in his thesis. The Bible itself affirms that Old Testament religion is fatally flawed and anticipates something better. Look again at verses 7 and 8 of chapter 8. If there had been nothing wrong with the first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. But God found fault with the people and said, the time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Now, if Melchizedek was someone you'd never heard of, it may very well be that this word covenant is a trifle strange to you as well. So let me just explain a little of the background to it. In the ancient Near East, when a powerful king conquered a minor state, something which, of course, is very much in the news right now, he might very well establish his covenant with it. This was a kind of treaty enacted between a strong party and a weaker one. The weaker party in the arrangement undertook to be a loyal ally of the king, to obey his laws and pay his taxes and so forth. And the king, for his part, undertook to protect this vassal state from the aggression of other empires. Now, such covenant agreements were made in very solemn religious context in the ancient Near East. God was invoked as witness to the promises which both sides made, and a blood sacrifice was offered, which was probably a kind of gory warning of the fearful curse that would fall if this covenant was broken. There may very well have been a form of word used which went like this: so may the Lord do to me and more also, if I break my word. What's happened to this dismembered corpse which we have sacrificed today will be my fate if I break my vow. Now, one of the most extraordinary claims of Judaism is that God himself has entered such a covenant relationship with the nation of Israel. It had been enacted first in the days of Abraham, who was the father of the nation. God had established his covenant with Abraham. And then it had been confirmed in much greater detail with Moses at Mount Sinai. The moral rules that we're familiar with and call the Ten Commandments are in fact the covenant law of this sacred arrangement between God and Israel. They are the laws, the stipulations, which God, as the conquering king, has laid down for Israel, the dependent vassal state, to obey as their part in the covenant arrangement. Keep these laws of mine, he says, and I, the Lord, undertake to protect and bless you as my own people. Now, it sounded a great arrangement. I mean, what nation could be more secure than to have the Lord of heaven as its covenant king? But unfortunately, it didn't work. And the writer tells us why in verse 8. God found fault with the people, he says. The plain fact is that Israel didn't keep God's covenant law as he required. They were constantly flouting it, worshipping idols, practicing immorality, fostering social injustice, you name it, they did it. And the prophets who follow Moses in the Old Testament never tire of reciting this sorry tale of the nation's sins and the consequences of it. The consequence being, of course, that inevitably the people reaped the curse of the covenant. They had entered this solemn contract with God. By disobeying his law, God's protection and blessing was forfeit. So other powers, other kings, other empires conquered and dispossessed them. They lost their territory, they lost their political independence, they lost their temple, they lost everything. It's your own fault, the prophet said. You've broken the covenant. Eventually, it's the prophet Jeremiah, one of the greatest of the Old Testament prophets, whom we find languishing in Jerusalem only a year or two before it finally capitulates to Babylonian destruction, before God's judgment has its final way upon this city. Only a little time left, only a few more years to survive, and the Jewish people will be cast completely into exile, and everything their nation stood for will be razed to the ground. Jeremiah knows it. And significantly, it is he, on the very threshold of this final stroke of divine judgment, who's shown by the Holy Spirit a ray of hope within this tragic story of failure. These words, which we find in Hebrews 8, are a quotation from Jeremiah chapter 31. The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, and I turned away from them, declares the Lord. Now, this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel this time, declares the Lord. I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord. They will all know me, from the least to the greatest. For I will forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more. Now, just put yourself in Jeremiah's shoes. What a marvelous prospect. A new covenant. A covenant that replaces the disappointments of the old covenant which Israel had broken with a fresh opportunity to enjoy God's blessing once again. What's more, says Jeremiah, no longer will these blessings of God, these blessings of the covenant, be vulnerable because of the people's rebellious inclinations. For this time, he says, God intends to write his covenant law not upon tablets of stone, like he did for Moses, which the people could so easily ignore. No, he was going to write his covenant law this time on their hearts and on their minds. No longer, he says, would the people need constant encouragement and instruction from prophets and teachers to sustain their knowledge of God, lest they fall into idolatry. For in this covenant, every one of them will have a personal relationship with God, from the youngest and most insignificant to the oldest and most eminent. And most important of all, no longer would the curse of the covenant have to be invoked as the penalty for the people's moral intransigence, because no matter how far short they fall of God's standard, the clauses of this new covenant would guarantee forgiveness of sin for them as an inalienable possession. I will forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more, promises God. Oh, it's an extraordinary prophecy. But Jeremiah is as good as saying that God intends to make a covenant with his people which is completely impregnable. There is no way such a covenant can ever be forfeit, because God has anticipated all the potential sources of weakness and taken care of them in advance. This is a foolproof, leak-proof, armor-plated dreadnought of a covenant. And says Jeremiah, it's definitely coming. Now, how it is that God is able to offer a relationship with himself on such generous terms, our author will have more to say a little later on. But in chapter 8, the first point he wants to establish, to deduce from this famous passage from Jeremiah 31, is the very obvious one. If God intends to enact such a new covenant under such terms, why then, he says, it clearly implies that the old covenant is going to be superseded, doesn't it? Verse 13. By calling this covenant new, he's made the first one obsolete. And what is obsolete and aging will soon disappear. See what I mean then when I say the Bible itself affirms that Old Testament religion is fatally flawed and anticipates something better to replace it. How can anybody who knows Jeremiah's prophecy deny this, says our author? And he continues, if you still need to be convinced on the point, I have yet a third observation to make from the Old Testament in support of my general thesis. And so we come to our third plank in his argument. The Bible itself indicates that the ritual of the temple was provisional and ineffective. Now, this is what dominates chapters 9 and 10. Just look at the opening verses of chapter 10 to get the flavor of it. The law is only a shadow, he says, of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. For this reason, it can never, by the same sacrifices repeated endlessly year after year, make perfect those who draw near to worship. If it could, would they not have stopped being offered? For the worshippers would have been cleansed once for all and would no longer have felt guilty for their sins. But those sacrifices are an annual reminder of sins. That's the best they can be, he says. It is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. It's quite likely our writer here is exploiting a special interest of his audience. Many educated Jews in the first century were very influenced by the Greek philosopher Plato. They found Plato's ideas, though pagan in inspiration, very congenial to their monotheistic worldview. Let me explain why. One of the things Plato was very interested in was to understand what it was made one thing better than another. I mean, take a chair, for instance. We have a few in the place today. Some chairs are elegant and some are ugly. Some chairs are comfortable and some are decidedly not. Some chairs are well-made and some are cheap and nasty. On what basis do we make such assessments? How do we evaluate, assess the goodness or badness of a chair? Plato argued that this kind of value judgment is only meaningful because there exists an invisible world of perfect forms. In that world, for instance, there is a perfect chair, a kind of ideal archetype. All real chairs that you and I are familiar with are imperfect copies of this ideal archetypal chair. And the nearer the copy gets to the form of the ideal, then the better chair it is. One of the famous illustrations Plato used to try and make this point was to liken this world to a cave in which we are all sitting with our backs to the light. All we can see, he says, are the shadows on the cave wall. We take those shadows for reality, but in fact, they are no more than hazy outlines of the perfect forms which are outside in the sunlight. We don't see the real things, we only see copies of them, silhouettes of them. Now, it's not hard to see how Jews were attracted to Plato's ideas, because you see, this invisible world of ideal forms was very easily identified with heaven. God it is who defines perfection and who arbitrates the validity of our human value judgments by his eternal and unchanging standards. He's the one who defines the perfect forms, not just about chairs, but about morals. Now, as I say, it's extremely likely that our author's audience were familiar with these ideas. Scholars find many subtle points of contact in this letter to the Hebrews with Platonic thought. And this first verse of chapter 10, you see, is a classic example. There was another one back in chapter 8, for those of you who noticed it. The law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. You see how that makes contact with Plato. Our author is saying the old covenant, with its priesthood and its ceremonial, which these Jews he's writing to were disposed to think so highly of, that old covenant, he says, was in fact nothing more than one of those shadows on the cave wall that Plato talks about. Its form communicates important truths about God, undoubtedly. It communicates things about his plan of salvation, sure. But it isn't the reality. It isn't the plan. It's only a cloudy and indistinct silhouette of the plan. And to prove his point, in the previous chapter, chapter 9, he has gone about reminding his readers of the priestly ritual associated with what was undoubtedly the most important day of all in the Jewish liturgical calendar, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Now, you can read all about the Day of Atonement, if you want, in Leviticus chapter 16. Now, we can't go into the details now, but anyway, in the earlier part of our service, we were subtly familiarized with some of it, if you noticed. Suffice it to say that on the Day of Atonement, the high priest was meant to secure forgiveness of sins for the people of Israel. He did this by offering a special sacrifice and taking the blood of that sacrifice through a curtain in the temple or in the tabernacle into an inner sanctum, the most holy place, as it was called. This most holy place behind the curtain was only entered on this one occasion each year and only by the high priest, because it contained the sacred Ark of the Covenant. This was an ornamented wooden box upon which the invisible Jehovah was believed to sit enthroned. The inner sanctum was his throne room. It was as close as you could get in temple, liturgical, ritual terms to God. Now, says our author, all this ceremonial of the Day of Atonement is no doubt very impressive. But just think about it a little. There are several features of the Day of Atonement ritual which clearly indicate the unsatisfactory nature of old covenant religion. For a start, he says, there's the limited access to the most holy place, which this Day of Atonement ritual highlights. Only the high priest could get in there, and only once a year. So he says in verse 8 of chapter 9, the Holy Spirit was showing clearly by this that the way into the most holy place has not yet really been opened, it's not yet really been disclosed. Then he says there's the limited nature of the sins which the Day of Atonement could deal with. Because the Old Testament is quite clear, only sins of ignorance and of ceremonial defilement could be forgiven by this sacrificial ceremony. Deliberate criminal offences against God's law had no remedy on the Day of Atonement except the penalty which the covenant law laid down. That's why our writer says in verse 9, the gifts and sacrifices that were being offered were not able to clear the conscience of the worshipper. They could only deal with matters of food and drink and ceremonial washings and such like, he says. But perhaps most significant of all is the point he makes at the beginning of chapter 10. And that is the repeated nature of this ritual. Year after year, it went on, endlessly offering the same sacrifices. Well, he reasons, there's only one conclusion you can come to. If you have to go on doing it over and over again like that, the sacrifices can't work very well, can they? I mean, if they did work well, the people would have felt forgiven, would have felt that their sins had been forgiven and forgotten, as we say. The very repetition of the ceremony only serves to reawaken their conscience to new anxiety every year. Clearly, that's the purpose of it. Now, thinking Jews had long ago realized this. Only the most primitive superstition could seriously believe that slaughtering animals and throwing their blood around could make any real difference to a man's relationship with God. No, of course it can't. These sacrifices, repeated year after year, can't make perfect those who draw near to worship, he says. They can't really deal with people's alienation from God. If they could, they would have stopped being offered. The worshippers would have been cleansed once and for all and would no longer have felt guilty for their sins. But the fact is, they felt as sinful before the Day of Atonement as they did after it. That's why it had to be a yearly event, because he says, these sacrifices are an annual reminder of sins. To put it in Plato's language, the ritual is nothing more than a shadow on the wall. It's not reality itself. The very nature of this Old Testament ritual is clearly provisional and ineffective. 4 verse 4, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Well, there we have it then. There are his three arguments drawn from the Old Testament themselves. The Bible itself predicts the Messiah will belong to a new order of priesthood. The Bible itself affirms that Old Testament religion is fatally flawed and anticipates something better. And finally, the Bible itself indicates the ritual of the temple is provisional and ineffective. Three arguments. Now the $64,000 question. If the religion of Moses is so inadequate and so unsatisfactory, if God has promised a new covenant and a new priesthood to deal with these unsatisfactory and inadequate consequences of it, where is it? Well, you don't need me to tell you the author's answer to that, do you? It's Jesus. If you scan these four chapters, you will find that he has woven again and again and again in a most complex way Jesus into his discussion, showing repeatedly how it is that Jesus meets exactly the points of failure and of anticipation in all of these three parts of the Old Testament that he's referred to. To be a Christian, he says, is not just to be a Jew masquerading under a different name. On the contrary, Judaism and Christianity, though they may belong to the same genus of monotheistic religions, are quite distinct species within that genus. Indeed, it's not too much to say that Christianity is to Judaism what Concord is to a pair of roller skates. Jesus is this priest after the order of Melchizedek, of which Psalm 110 speaks. Jesus is the mediator of that new covenant of which Jeremiah 31 speaks. Don't you remember at the Last Supper? This is the blood of the new covenant, he said. But most of all, Jesus is the spiritual reality of which the shadows of all that Old Testament ritual in the book of Leviticus speaks. See how he makes that point in verse 11 of chapter 9. Christ came as a high priest of the good things that are already here. He went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not man-made, that is to say, not part of this creation. He did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves. He entered the most holy place once and for all by his own blood, having obtained eternal redemption. If the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who are ceremonially unclean sanctifies them so they are outwardly clean, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death so that we may serve the living God? For this reason, Christ is the mediator of a new covenant, that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, now that he has died as a ransom to set them free from the sins they committed under the first covenant. Now, there is so much here that it is an embarrassment to the preacher. But let me just try to summarize to you the essence of what our author is trying to get across, not just here in chapter 9, verses 11 to 15, but in several places here as he elucidates the Jesus-centered implications of all those Old Testament passages. He's saying, do you remember that old movable shrine which Moses built before we had a proper temple? where the Day of Atonement ritual was first performed, in the wilderness, before we got to Palestine. Do you remember that old tent, the tabernacle, as it was called? Well, he says that tabernacle was just another shadow on the cave wall. After all, nobody really believes that God lives in a goatskin tent, do they? No, it was just an earthly symbolic representation of a spiritual reality. God dwells, as we all know, in unapproachable light. His fiery holiness would consume any sinner who presumed to come within a million miles of him. And that curtain that separated the most holy place from the rest of the sanctuary was a symbol of that impenetrable barrier of holiness that separates the sacred perfection of God from the profanity and the corruption of us and our fallen world. Now, how could a holy God ever break that barrier down? How could a holy God ever reconcile himself to a sinful people? How can we ever get from this side of the curtain to the other in symbolic, in ritual terms? Well, he says the ritual of the Day of Atonement gave us a picture of that. That's all it was, a picture, nothing more. A glimmer of anticipatory light falling on the cave wall. The blood of an animal sprinkled in that most holy place by the high priest once a year. Oh, it couldn't really take away sins. Of course it couldn't. But it symbolized the seriousness of the sin problem and the costliness of any solution that God might provide for it. See, that blood was a picture, a signpost directed to the future. It was pointing to a far nobler sacrifice that would be offered by a far greater priest, Jesus. Jesus, he says, didn't go through the curtain of some inferior man-made tabernacle. Jesus has passed through the real spiritual curtain that separates earth from heaven. Jesus did not take the ineffectual blood of goats and calves on that momentous journey. He took his own blood. The blood of God shed upon the earth as the ransom of men's sins. In an awesome stroke of divine justice. For in the death, you see, of which that blood is the gory token, he paid the penalty which the old covenant law lays upon sinners like us. In that death, he bore the curse of the covenant, which we must inherit as those who have broken God's law. He puts it in verse 15. Christ can be the mediator of the new covenant now because he has died as a ransom to set people free from the sins they committed under the first covenant. If Jesus hadn't died, if he hadn't offered himself in that atoning way, the new covenant could never have come into being. God could never have offered the new covenant in the terms of which he speaks. But because Jesus has died, this great new covenant, this dreadnought of a covenant, which cannot be broken, because our sins are forgiven and God's law is placed in our hearts, this new covenant can now be inaugurated. Jesus is the mediator of it, he says. He has made the way, you see, for this holy God to deal with sinful people on such generous terms as the new covenant provides. For by his one sacrifice, he has the power not only to forgive venial sins of ignorance and ceremonial defilement, no, Jesus has the power to cleanse mortal sins of the most heinous kind, as he puts it in verse 14, acts that lead to death, the sorts of sins the old covenant couldn't do anything about. But Jesus can forgive them. By his one sacrifice, he says, he has power not only to deal with minor misdemeanors of the previous 12 months, he offers a full satisfaction for the entire weight of human sinfulness from the fall of Adam to the end of the world. He has, by this one sacrifice, for all time, he says, obtained an eternal redemption. And it follows, of course, that by his sacrifice he has rendered obsolete and redundant, all those former types and shadows of Jewish ceremonial. He puts it candidly in verse 23 of chapter 9. You might be able to cleanse a pretend sanctuary, like the Jewish tabernacle, with the blood of animals, he says. You're just playing games and symbols. But if we human beings are really going to stand in the presence of a holy God, we need a better solution to the sin problem than that. And Jesus has provided it. So he says in verse 24, Christ did not enter a man-made sanctuary that was only a copy of the true one. He entered heaven itself, now to appear for us in God's presence. Nor did he enter heaven to offer himself again and again, the way the high priest enters the most holy place every year with blood that isn't his own. For then Christ would have had to suffer many times since the creation of the world. But now he has appeared once for all, at the end of the ages, to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. Just as man is destined, he says, to die once, and after that to face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people. And he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. Well, here we have it then. You want to know what a Christian is? You want to know what a Christian really is? We are now in a position to say. A Christian is a person who can stand before a holy God on the last day and not be afraid. That's what a Christian is. Man is destined to die once, and after that to face judgment, says our author. Do you think he's wrong about that? Can you honestly say it will come as some great surprise to you when you find yourself arraigned at God's bar of justice? I don't believe it. Of course it won't. We all know we are responsible moral agents. Well, who are we responsible to? We all know we are accountable. Well, to whom shall we give account? It will be no surprise when we find ourselves facing God's bar of justice. Of course it won't. We're expecting it. But what are we going to say on that horrendous day? It's all right, God, I'm a Christian. I believe in your existence, you see. Do you think that will meet the need of the hour? I tell you, no. God will say, you believe in my existence. Well, big deal. So does the devil. And a lot of good it does him. Are you going to say, it's all right, God, I'm a Christian. I've always sought to live a good life. Do you think that will meet the need of the hour? I tell you, no. Heaven will reply, good try. Unfortunately, not good enough. You may have done a great deal, but you haven't done enough. Nobody ever has. For God's pass marks 100%, and even you have failed to meet it. But you say, it's okay, God. I'm a Christian. I went to church every Sunday down there. Will that meet the need of the hour? I tell you, no. Heaven will reply, well, that's very laudable of you. Great thing to go to church as a regular habit. But you don't seriously think that listening to sermons and participating in ecclesiastical ceremonies is going to make any difference to the way heaven views your moral record, do you? If you went to the courts of Cambridge on a charge of speeding, do you think it would make any difference to them that you told them you were speeding on your way to church? If it won't make any difference to the magistrate, it certainly won't make any difference to God, will it? Now, if that's what you think, you have misunderstood what Christianity is. Christianity is not mere theism, believing in God. Christianity is not mere moralism, trying to be good. Christianity is not mere pietism, going to church. Christianity is Christ. You want to know whether you're a Christian or not? Ask yourself, where does Jesus figure in my scheme of things? I can believe in God, try to be good and go to church, and have no part in Jesus at all. He can have no relevance to me. What's Christian about that? Now, you want to know whether you're a Christian or not? Ask where Jesus figures in your life. Because for a real Christian, Jesus is absolutely central. And if you've understood even a half of what we've been saying this morning, you will understand why. Jesus is the one who has made a relationship with God possible. It's his death that has torn down the curtain and provided us, sinful though we are, with access to God. Christianity doesn't invite you to obey the Ten Commandments as best you can. Christianity invites you to find the assurance that every sin you have ever committed is forgiven by the atoning sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. Christianity doesn't invite you to come to church every week and engage in the hocus-pocus of some sacramental ritual. Christianity invites you to be baptized into a community of saved men and women. People who have found the personal benefits of Christ and who therefore don't need any priests, don't need any sacrifices, don't need any rituals. That's why the church has none, if it's a real church. Christianity, you see, is a better kind of religion. A religion of which all other religions are, at best, imperfect shadows and types. Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, I'm sure they all have their strengths. I know they all have their strengths. I have a great respect for some of the representatives of these great world faiths that I've known personally. But when we stand before God in final judgment, there will be no comfort in any of them. Day after day, the priest stands and performs his religious duties, says our writer in verse 11 of chapter 10. Again and again he offers the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. He would say the same about all the religious ritual of this entire world. Whatever its origins or traditions, whatever it calls itself, whatever label it parades under, day after day it performs the religious duties, offering the same old routine of ritual, which can never take away sins. But when Jesus, our priest, had offered for all time one sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. And since that time, he waits for his enemies to be made his footstool, because by one sacrifice he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. Now tell me, have you embraced this better religion? Because, putting it very bluntly, if you haven't, you aren't ready to die. You aren't ready to die and face judgment if you haven't embraced this better religion yet. See how our writer in verse 19 of chapter 10 invites us to become Christians. Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body, since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience, and having our bodies washed with pure water. Let's pray together.